From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, China, its growing economy, its dismal human rights record, and the new generation of entrepreneurs, dissidents, and bohemians. We talk with New York Times journalists Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. They got married just before their five-year stint covering China for the Times. They won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Now they've collaborated on the new book, China Wakes. Then we'll talk with Orville Schell. In his new book about China, Mandate of Heaven, he says that political dissidence has been suppressed, but subversive pop culture is beginning to flourish. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews two new series, Mad Men of the People, starring Dabney Coleman, and The Martin Short Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says NATO warplanes struck at Bosnian Serb positions just outside Sarajevo today. It was in retaliation for a Bosnian Serb rocket attack on UN peacekeepers. The UN is authorized to call on NATO jets for protection anytime peacekeepers are attacked. This is apparently the second airstrike in less than 2 months by NATO on Bosnian Serbs. NATO jets destroyed a Bosnian Serb anti-tank gun on August 5th after the Serbs seized weapons from a UN-guarded weapons depot near Sarajevo. The Pentagon says American troops are now in place in Haiti. Deputy Defense Secretary John Deutsch says the American patrols should help cut attacks by Haitian police on civilians. The U.S. troops no longer have to stand by and watch as Haitian police attack citizens. Colonel Barry Willey says it will be up to a soldier's best judgment when to intervene, but they're being instructed only to act when there is sufficient backup. The U.S. military has resumed Cuban refugee flights to Panama. Tomas Cabal reports from Panama City.
The United States Southern Command continued the transfer of Cuban refugees from Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba to camps built by American military engineers in the vicinity of the Panama Canal. According to Lieutenant Colonel Melanie Reeder, the flights from Guantanamo to Howard Air Force Base in Panama had been suspended due to the situation in Haiti. More than 1,300 of the expected 10,000 Cuban citizens have already made the trip under an agreement reached with the Panamanian government that will allow them to stay in the country for a period of 6 months. For National Public Radio, this is Tomas Carral in Panama City.
Senate Republicans are stalling a bill to change the way that congressional campaigns are being financed. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has this report.
A Democratic bill to put spending limits on campaigns and provide some taxpayer subsidies for candidates for Congress is being stalled by Republicans. They're slowing down the process by which House and Senate members could create a compromise bill. Democrat Boren of Oklahoma, who's leaving the Senate voluntarily, despite good re-election prospects, says the bill is needed because lawmakers spend far too much time raising money.
The average senator has to figure out how to raise $13,000 every single week for 6 years to raise the amount of money on the average that it takes to get re-elected.
Republicans traditionally spend more than Democrats and refuse to agree to any spending limits. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
The commissioner of the National Hockey League says the hockey season will be put on hold if an agreement isn't reached in the league's labor dispute. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman made the announcement today after a conference call following 2 days of failed negotiations with the Players Association. The season is supposed to start October 1st. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 16.5 points at 3,885. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up a fraction at 760. This is NPR. The Justice Department is trying to deport an accused Nazi who's been living in the United States for nearly 40 years. 87-year-old Alexandras Lilalaikas once reportedly headed a Nazi-sponsored police force in Lithuania. That force was linked to the deaths of tens of thousands of Jews in that country during the Second World War. The acting director of the Justice Department's Nazi hunting unit says the Lilalaikas was a senior-level perpetrator of the Holocaust. The agency filed a civil lawsuit against him yesterday, claiming he hid his past when he applied for immigration to the United States in 1955 and then for citizenship. If the court revokes his citizenship, deportation proceedings would start. Firefighters in Northern California are fighting a large wildfire in Lassen National Forest. Jocelyn O'Neill of North State Public Radio reports.
Major wildfire ignited Wednesday by a lightning strike continues to burn out of control 25 miles north of Chico, a university community of about 75,000 people. 2,000 firefighters are battling the blaze. California Forestry spokeswoman Lisa Randall says there is much hard work ahead.
The fire is currently 23,000 acres and it's burning in very remote, rugged, steep country. We've had erratic fire weather, lots of high winds, it's very dry, and it burns as well at nighttime as well as it does in the daytime. And that's difficult for us because it's burning when we can't see it at night, and we're not able to use the support of aircraft during the night.
Fire officials say there is no estimate of containment. For National Public Radio, I'm Jocelyn O'Neill in Chico.
The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation reports the nation's banks are continuing financial recovery. The FDIC says commercial banks earned more than $11 billion in the second quarter of this year. That's the second best showing for a quarter ever. It's also an 8% improvement over the same time period a year ago. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says the conditions of the country's banks has improved. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn covered China for the New York Times for 5 years. They fell in love with the country when they moved there in 1988. They had their hearts broken the next year in Tiananmen Square as they watched China go mad. They won Pulitzer Prizes for their coverage of the massacre. Of course, as they watched China, the Chinese authorities watched them. Even when Kristof and Wu Dunn went jogging, five guys tailed them. Kristof and Wu Dunn got married shortly before moving to China. Now they've collaborated on a new book called China Wakes, The Struggle for the Soul of a Rising Power. Cheryl is Chinese-American. I asked if she thought that looking Chinese gave her more access to certain people and stories.
I certainly did. I was very lucky in some respects, but the experience was not always very happy. I remember one time when I was looking into the problem of sexual harassment of the status of women in China, and I was at a party one night, and a cabinet minister came over to me and asked me to dance. He must have thought that I was a local secretary or something, and we got out to the dance floor, and all of a sudden he tried to force himself upon me. I was shocked, but it gave me enormous insight into the problems of women. And it's one thing to read about and to intellectualize the inequality of the sexes there, but it's another thing to be crushed in the arms of a cabinet minister.
Did you tell him who you were?
I did, and then all of a sudden he froze. And he didn't ask me for the second dance.
It really worked out. I think it really worked out very well sometimes to have a combination of a Chinese American and a Caucasian American because, for example, I could go to Beijing University and talk to students there. They knew I wasn't a government spy. That occasionally was a help. While Cheryl, 90% of the time, it was a help for her to have her natural camouflage. You know, for these government goons who were tailing us, Cheryl could go in one end of a subway and come out the other, and they'd lose her in between. They could never tail her very far. And that was a tremendous help, especially in the years after Tiananmen when people were, you know, terribly worried about getting in trouble.
Nick, I know you write that you were often scolded about the stories you were writing by the foreign ministry liaison. And in 1992, the foreign ministry summoned you for regular struggle sessions. What are the struggle sessions?
Well, they would be upset about one article that I'd written or another, or occasionally about Cheryl's articles. And I mean, I always wondered what they expected me to do at that point, you know, divorce her?
Discipline her, maybe.
I suppose. And they would... what they were fundamentally doing was that they had been scolded by some other branch of the government, and they wanted to put something in the file showing that the foreign ministry had denounced me. They were really protecting themselves.
So what's a struggle session like?
I get called in, usually on about 20 minutes' notice, to go to the foreign ministry immediately, and then I'm greeted very sternly by our liaison, who has a personality like a fingernail on a chalkboard, and then a note taker. And we sit it in a big conference room, and the foreign ministry fellow says, you know, Mr. Kristof, you have hurt the feelings of the Chinese people with your slanderous attack on the Chinese government, and we will not stand up for this. And then typically I would say, well, if I've made a mistake, you know, we'd love to correct it in the New York Times. We actually have corrections in the Times, unlike People's Daily, and, you know, tell me what the mistake was. And then they would sort of fidget and read it over again, and, you know, then we'd offer to print a letter to the editor. And at this point, their note taker would typically be giggling. Insufficient ideological training.
So were you ever punished?
No, they came pretty close, I think, a couple of times to kicking us out of the country. But in the end, they didn't. And, you know, there really wasn't much that they could do to punish us. Our fear wasn't so much getting kicked out. It was really that they would punish our Chinese friends. And that was the worst burden that we faced.
Nicholas, you write in the book that China is confusing because it marks the intersection of the two most important trends of the late 20th century, the collapse of communism and the rise of East Asia as an independent powerhouse. Which direction do you think China is heading in now, a more last bastion of communism direction or the new economic powerhouse?
Well, we have every reason, I suppose, to think that it's the last bastion of communism, you know, between being tailed, between seeing kids killed at Tiananmen Square, between having very good friends who are still in prison today. And yet, we think that, you know, the most important thing happening in China and probably in the world today in general is this economic explosion in China that's just transforming the lives of 1.2 billion people.
China is the most populous nation in the world. I mean, every one in every five people on this planet is a Chinese person. It's just unthinkable what the possibilities are if China becomes the largest economy, which it might be, and according to current trajectories, by sometime the next century.
You write that if and when the Communist Party collapses, corruption will be one of the major reasons why. You saw corruption on the rise during your years in China.
Yeah. We welcome, obviously, the rise of a market economy and the collapse of any kind of sort of Maoist ideals. But a market is rising in kind of strange ways sometimes in China. I mean, for example, there's one village called Haotou in Guangdong province, and it decided it wanted to find its niche in the market economy. So the people in the village just began kidnapping young women in other villages, forcing them back to their village, and forcing them to work in brothels in that town. I mean, that little village was the sort of ran the brothel industry in the area. And they decided this was the market economy. This is fair game.
You know, corruption in China used to be a traffic cop taking 10 yuan, the equivalent of $1 or $2, instead of issuing a parking ticket. Now it's the cops in cahoots with the crooks running brothels and smuggling rings that are even taking human beings from the southern part of China to New York City on boats like the Golden Venture. The best way to think of it, it's mafia style. And one way to think about it is if you have a car stolen in Philadelphia or in New York, you might want to take a trip to southern China and look at the used car lots there, because you might find your car with the Philadelphia or New York license plates on it. And the way it got there, just like thousands of other cars that are stolen each year from the U.S., is that they're smuggled over to China with the complicity of the authorities, of the customs officials and the army. And they're registered to new Chinese owners with the help of the local police. It's all open.
Did you drive while you were there?
Yes, we did.
What'd you drive?
We drove a Beijing Jeep.
With scratches on both sides, courtesy of the State Security Service. They wanted to be able to identify our car more easily, so they scratched both sides.
Cheryl, when you first got to China, you were at first very impressed with the number of working women and the independence that women seem to have, and then you found yourself getting less impressed with the strides that women seem to have changed. What did you notice the longer you were there?
I realized that for thousands of years, Chinese women had been thought of as no more than just walking wombs. And, for instance, my grandmother had her feet bound and wobbled for the rest of her life whenever she walked. After 15 years of reform, I had initially thought that the status of women would have improved dramatically. But in many ways, I found that to be the opposite. I found that with the rise of the market, it came the rise of sinister industries you might have the cotton market, you might have a market or a trade in copper or toys, but there's also a trade in women. There are established networks of businessmen and even women who go to peasant villages and they recruit women there with the promise of greater jobs and higher pay, and they transport them to faraway places where they don't know the local dialect. If you don't know the local dialect in place, you basically can't communicate. And they sell these women to uneducated peasants. And if anyone tries to escape, if a woman tries to escape, she's usually beaten up. I know in one case, a terrible situation where the woman tried to escape and the peasant basically blinded her. He gouged out her eyes.
Cheryl, you mentioned that your grandmother, who was born in China, but then came to America, that she had her feet bound when she was young. Did you see her feet when you were growing up?
My mother, she was on my mother's side, and unfortunately my grandmother died before I was born.
What did your mother tell you about what your grandmother's feet looked like?
It was always a very sensitive topic in the home. They didn't really want to talk about it, but my mother was saying that she always remembered her mother's feet as just square blocks, square flat blocks, and that she always walked very funny, and she couldn't walk for very long periods of time.
So what did you grow up thinking about how women had been treated in China?
Well, when I was growing up in the U.S., China was a remote land to me, and although I'd grown up with stories of the motherland, I'd never really focused on the treatment of women. It wasn't until I actually got to China and saw that this there's such an enduring tradition of the worthlessness of women. And that is resurging now with the rise of the economy. This is a very surprising thing. Of course, there is greater opportunity for women in China now, and I don't want to diminish that. But there are fewer controls now, and Mao Zedong basically used his political will to tell China that women should hold up half the sky. But now that's receding.
One of the saddest things is the way technology is affecting the status of women. You know, the bit of modern equipment that I think is changing China the most in the 1990s isn't the car or, you know, the computer. It's the ultrasound machine. And in this kind of country that has a 4,000-year-old tradition of favoring boys, and where peasants are typically limited to just one or maybe two kids each, then they're using ultrasound machines. And when a woman is pregnant, she goes to this ultrasound operator and finds out the sex of the baby. If it's a girl, then the woman gets an abortion. And, you know, as a result, you've got 1.7 million girls missing each year.
Have there been recent changes in the population policy that have been responsible for increasing the amount of female infanticide?
It's hard to say whether or not they've caused more female infanticide, but there's certainly been a change in the policy, a tremendous crackdown. And it's ironic. It's a story, in effect, that I think we were proudest of breaking and the one that we were sort of most ashamed of breaking. It was a big crackdown launched in 1991. It led to the forced sterilization of millions of women. Probably nowhere in the world was there any government policy that affected so many people in such an intimate way. And, you know, Cheryl and I broke the story 2 years later. It took us 2 years to notice that you'd had this incredible change of policy affecting, you know, 900 million Chinese peasants. And I think that underscores the way everybody is out of touch with the Chinese countryside, and unfortunately, including us.
How many children does the government allow a family to have now in China?
The official policy is one, and then in some areas it's two. And depending upon the remoteness of the area, they allow three and four. It varies from area to area.
And how is it enforced?
Coercively, unfortunately.
So I guess the forced sterilizations you're referring to was part of the enforcement policy.
Right. Or you can get your home knocked down if you have a child that you're not supposed to, for example. But typically, the basic way in which it's enforced is not so much through fines or even knocking your home down, but family planning authorities go to every village, typically twice a year in the fall and in the spring, and they round up all the women who've had their quota of babies, and then, you know, herd them off to a family planning clinic to be either sterilized or to have an IUD inserted.
And sometimes, because of the very complex quota system, the results are just horrific. We saw a document, a confidential document, that described the case of a woman who was, in her third term of pregnancy, and the authorities, because they wanted to have a certain number of births in 1992 rather than 1993, they wanted her to give birth in 1992. So when she was less than 7 months pregnant, They dragged her off to the local clinic and forced her to have the baby. Well, the baby was born dead, and she was crippled for life.
My guests are Cheryl Wu Dunn and Nicholas Kristof. They covered China for 5 years for the New York Times. Now they've written a new book called China Wakes. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times reporters Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. Their new book is called China Wakes. You won Pulitzer Prizes for your coverage of Tiananmen Square. Nicholas, you write that what happened in Tiananmen Square just immediately changed your emotions about that country.
I think that it's hard not to be standing on Tiananmen Square that night, watching as it's lit by the glow of these armored personnel carriers, and seeing these troops fire on you and on the kids around you and not be enormously changed. But one way I think in which that really did change me perhaps the most is that we tend in this country to be often very patronizing about peasants and about whether uneducated people can support some kind of a more democratic system. And clearly there are problems in a place that doesn't have a lot of education to have a working democracy. But, you know, that night, when they were firing on us, I was cowering. My notebook was stained with sweat from fear, and the students were cowering in fear. But when there was a lull in the firing, it was these peasants who were rickshaw drivers, barefoot, uneducated people, probably illiterate. And they got on their rickshaws, and they drove out toward the troops. And they loaded up the bodies of the dead and the wounded and put them back on the rickshaws and then drove back to safety. To the hospitals, tears streaming down their cheeks, their legs pumping away at the rickshaws. And, you know, I mean, here we are in a country in the U.S. where, you know, a lot of PhDs don't want to risk bad weather to go out and vote. And so to see these uneducated peasants, rickshaw drivers, risking their lives and losing their lives to promote democracy was something that I will never, never forget.
Now that the student dissidents have been arrested or driven underground, what do you think has replaced them as the primary dissident voice in China?
Right now, there isn't much of a dissident voice in China, and I think that the reason is that people are afraid. You know, that we make the mistake in this country of thinking that Chinese protest when they're most outraged, and they don't. They protest when they think they can get away with it. And it's pretty clear now that any Chinese, if he takes to the streets, that he's going to get arrested. The most prominent dissident, Wei Jingsheng, just got tossed back into the same prisons in which he'd already spent 15 years. And so I think that what is going to happen is we're going to have to wait until there is some easing of the repression and when people think, for whatever constellation of factors, that they can get away with it. And then I think we're going to see more voices of protest.
You said that you think the industrial labor force is a possible rival to the power of the Communist Party.
Absolutely.
What's happening there? Are you talking about people organizing?
Well, Marx wasn't entirely wrong. I mean, the industrial labor force does have tremendous potential power, and the Chinese communist leaders read their Marx. One problem with the past democracy movements is these were led by eggheads, by students, by intellectuals. There are some labor leaders who are trying to organize these workers, and it's tremendously combustible material. I mean, these are workers who are angry at corruption, angry at inflation, angry at the risk of layoffs. So far, the government has tried very, very hard to crack these underground movements, and this leader I mentioned, Wei Jingsheng, the dissident, one reason he was put back in prison is that he's an extraordinarily articulate and charismatic leader who perhaps could galvanize, at some point, the labor movement.
What do you think the United States should be doing in terms of its trade and human rights policies?
I think that the policy, the usage of the most favored nation status, was very effective when they first used it a few years ago. And the Chinese were extremely afraid that, that the status was going to be revoked and it would hurt trade between the two countries. It would hurt specifically Chinese exports to the U.S., which was earning China a lot of money. And so they released political prisoners. They did collapse. In the face of this kind of threat. But now, I think the tool is ineffective. It was like a trigger. We were holding a gun to China's head, but we weren't pulling the trigger. The Chinese knew we wouldn't. So we need to move on to different tools.
You were both in China from 88 to 93. How did you know it was time to leave?
It was partly because we were beginning to worry so much about getting our friends in trouble. I mean, during our last year, a number of foreign reporters had gotten Chinese reporters and Chinese friends sent to long prison terms. And, you know, you can last for 5 years without that happening, but sometime you're going to mess up.
It's a crazy way to live a life, you know. If you want to get in touch with a Chinese friend, then first of all, you can't write down that person's name and telephone number anywhere in your house. Cheryl and I couldn't have a conversation about any of these friends in our home or in our office because it was bugged. We'd have to go off to another telephone somewhere to make a telephone call to these people and set up an appointment. And we'd have to drive out and somehow lose the tails who were following us. And the whole time we'd meet with these people, especially if they were in some kind of sensitive position, you know, we'd be just terrified that, you know, our luck was going to run out, that they would figure out who we were talking to and arrest that person and destroy not only that person, but perhaps their family as well.
What would you do in China in your spare time?
We spent almost all of our time with our Chinese friends and you know, having dinners with them, going off to things, taking our baby and playing with them. But as reporters, the whole atmosphere sometimes becomes laced with mistrust. One of our closest friends in the post-Tiananmen period was a fellow we call in the book Hong Jun. It's a pseudonym. But, you know, we really trusted this guy. And then one day another friend came to us and said, you should know that, you know, this guy is a spy. And he's asking if you and Cheryl are writing a book, and are you writing it on the hard drive of your computer or on floppies? And, you know, we were crushed, and we went through and we established through other friends that he had been a spy all along and that he'd been attached to a reformist work unit, but that had just been a cover. So state security could send him off to talk to people. And we couldn't confront Hong Jun. We couldn't tell him what we knew because then he would figure out who had told us. And so we went through this charade of a relationship for the next few years where we would continue to have lunch with him. But, you know, we had to still pretend that he was a close friend. And then he asked us for a letter of recommendation to go to the U.S.
What did you do?
Well, I couldn't say no because he would have been suspicious. And so I wrote a very lukewarm letter. And then Cheryl and I agonized over this. Next time I was in Hong Kong and I knew I was on a phone line that wasn't tapped, I called up the head of the program and said, look, this guy is a very, very nice man and he's a spy. Well, and so Hong Jun and I continued to get together, and, you know, I like this guy, and he helped us. But we knew, as we'd sit there over lunch, that he had betrayed us, that he was trying to find out our sources, and we also knew that we had ruined his chances of going to the U.S. There was layers and layers of treachery there.
Yeah, it was like the typical Washington lunch, huh?
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thanks
very much.
Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn are co-authors of the new book, China Wakes. In the second part of our show, we'll talk with Orville Schell about the latest in Chinese pop culture. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You can now find a Hard Rock Cafe in China. Coming up, entrepreneurship and pop culture in the last bastion of communism. We talk with Orville Schell about his new book, Mandate of Heaven. He says now that political dissidence has been suppressed, young people are expressing themselves through pop culture. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews The Martin Short Show and Mad Men of the People, the new sitcom starring Dabney Coleman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Haiti's military leader says he won't leave the country when exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide returns, but the U.S. Embassy in Haiti says General Raoul Cedras won't have anything to contribute to the new government. U.S. officials say they're trying to encourage officials who support Aristide to leave hiding and move Haitian democracy forward. The BBC's Chris Nuttall reports from Port-au-Prince.
Haiti's military leaders are due to surrender power by October the 15th, and the Clinton administration has said it expects them to quit the country as well. But General Cedras was adamant in a television interview on Wednesday that he would not leave Haiti. At a news conference, the American embassy spokesman said the military leader would be encouraged to leave. He said it was hard to imagine that his power and influence would not be significantly marginalized after he stepped down, and he would have no legitimate role to play in the new constitutional government. The United States is trying to gather together legitimate remnants of President Aristide's government. Ambassador William Swing and the Joint Task Force Commander, General Henry Shelton, are meeting politicians and business and community leaders to brief them on the road back to democracy.
Chris Nuttall reporting. PLO leader Yasser Arafat has freed three members of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas. The three had been arrested by Palestinian authorities on suspicion of killing a Palestinian policeman in Gaza. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Arafat's decision came after his first official meeting with Hamas leaders since he moved back to Gaza in July. Hamas opposes the Israel-PLO peace deal, and Hamas militants have been responsible for several attacks on Israelis since the PLO took over Gaza and Jericho. Israel has said the PLO is not doing enough to find and prosecute the attackers. The meeting between Arafat and the Hamas leaders came after a Palestinian policeman was killed over the weekend in a shootout between armed Hamas men and Palestinian security forces. Hamas denied its men had killed the policeman. It was the first time such an incident had occurred in Gaza, and both the PLO and Hamas said they were concerned about the possibility of a civil war. Israel's likely to be worried about cooperation between the two Palestinian groups. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Northrop Grumman Corporation says it needs to cut 9,000 jobs over the next 15 months. The company says it will offer early retirement to about 5,000 employees. 47,500 people now work for the defense contractor. The conglomerate says cuts will come in California, New York, and Texas. About 4,500 people will be let go in California. Northrop acquired Grumman earlier this year. A spokesman says about 1,000 of the job cuts are directly related to the merger. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower for the third straight day. The Dow fell 14.5 points to end the day at 3,837. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Pope John Paul has canceled his trip to the United States for this year, but his trip to Asia, set for next year, is still on. The Vatican says John Paul plans to visit the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Australia, and Papua New Guinea in January. The Holy See says the pontiff isn't coming to the United States in October because he needs more physical therapy to recover from a fall last April. He had a hip replaced. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary has arrived in Islamabad, where she's leading a U.S. presidential mission on energy investment in Pakistan. O'Leary is accompanied by more than 50 corporate executives. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
During her four-day visit to Pakistan, O'Leary is scheduled to meet a variety of Pakistani government and business leaders in an effort to expand U.S.-Pakistan cooperation in the energy sector. One of the highlights of the trip will be a two-day conference where the U.S. delegation will join Pakistani experts to explore cooperation in electricity, oil, natural gas, and the environment. Corporate executives in the delegation will focus on the development of an action plan that will further strengthen Pakistan's investment climate. NPR spoke to the Energy Secretary by telephone during her stopover in Vienna. She said that U.S.-Pakistani business leaders are close to signing about $3 billion worth of commercial agreements. Economic advisor to the Pakistani prime minister says the two countries are expected to set up a joint investment fund during the visit. The fund, which will eventually be boosted to $450 million, will provide initial help to those interested in investing in Pakistan. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Some Senate Republicans are working on another crime bill made up from cuts from the last major package. Republican Senator Phil Graham says the measure would stiffen prison sentences for some drug offenders and other criminals. It would also make sure money for prison construction isn't used for prison alternatives. The legislation would also cut $5 billion in crime prevention programs. The GOP has criticized the recently passed crime measure as too soft on criminals. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Business is booming in the last bastion of communism. My guest Orville Schell has written a new book called Mandate of Heaven about the new generation of entrepreneurs, dissidents, bohemians, and technocrats who are shaping China's future. Schell has written several other books about China's politics and culture, including Discos and Democracy and To Get Rich is Glorious. He says you can learn a lot about what's happening in China now by looking at its pop culture.
You know, in a country like China, where political dissent is not possible without being arrested, or at least having dire consequences, people are forced to turn to other ways to express their dissatisfaction, their disappointment, their rebelliousness. And one of the ways they do it in China is obliquely through pop culture. And pop culture is much freer than official party-sponsored culture, because in many ways it's hooked right up to the market. So rock and roll, for one, is an area which really stands outside of all the officially sanctioned and officially subsidized and run institutions that used to comprise the total corpus of institutions in China. And it's very interesting to look at what these pop music singers are doing and saying and singing and how they're acting, because it suggests, I think, what's to come. I mean, pop culture is often a harbinger of politics of the future. And since we don't really have a tremendous amount of overt political expression, except in a few very diehard dissidents, this is where we have to look to see what the spirit of the times is saying.
You have a whole chapter about Chairman Mao as pop art. How is his image being used now as a pop culture fad?
Well, it's a very confusing situation. It started out a number of years ago when people began hanging little icons of Chairman Mao, little pictures of him laminated in plastic from their rearview mirrors of cars and buses and trucks. And then gradually these little icons, they got tassels and bells and gewgaws, and they got more and more sort of elaborate and fancy. And people did it because, well, they sort of liked the old guy, as he's referred to in Chinese, you know, talao renjia, as they say, the old fellow. But also because I think Mao, in a curious way, had been, it was a way to pull him down off a pedestal, make him real. They were also at the same time, paradoxically, turning him into a kind of a St. Christopher medal, something that would protect them. And taxi drivers would tell you, well, if they had Mao hanging there, they wouldn't have accidents, or they wouldn't get into trouble. So it was a funny way of taking Mao, hauling him down off this pedestal, making him sort of real, and also playing with him a little. And then artists began to get into the act, and not only did you get a lot of kitsch memorabilia, I went up to the Gate of Heavenly Peace in front of Tiananmen Square a few months ago, and there, where Mao used to stand to review the troops and review his people during these national days, there was just one long counter after another of sort of kitsch Mao pop stuff for sale. There were watches with holograms of Mao's face on the crystal. There were cigarette lighters with his face in vinyl on the side that beeped out electronic versions of The East is Red. They were pocket watches where, you know, little hands going around telling the time. And it was very strange. And you wonder what is happening. Well, what's happening is that Mao is being thrown into the marketplace. He's being consumed. And he's also being mortalized. And he's also being played with. And he's being turned into something that's less than the awe-inspiring great leader, which he once was, and who people feared and people obeyed. The government can't crack down because you seem to be extolling the patron saint of the Communist Party, but really you're kind of thumbing your nose at him.
But isn't Mao out now within the Communist Party as a symbol?
Not really. They don't know what to do with Mao. I mean, there he is, stuffed, you know, in his mausoleum out in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace, right in Tiananmen Square. I mean, he is still the sort of textual source for Communist Party doctrine, and they need to keep this doctrine because without it, how can they justify ruling alone, ruling unilaterally? Why shouldn't they have other parties competing with them? Well, they say they represent the interests of the proletariat, and Mao's doctrine is the canon that backs this up. So to get rid of Mao would be to completely undermine the justification for the party ruling alone. So they've got to keep him, even as they sort of they try to retreat a little bit, and even as he's being devoured by these sort of campy, kitschy industries that are making fortunes selling his visage in all over the country.
My guest is Orville Schell. His new book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Orville Schell. Earlier this year, there was a branch of the Hard Rock Cafe that opened in China. Who got it in there?
Well, you know, you can do almost anything in China today that isn't overtly political as long as it's business. And the Hard Rock Cafe is good business because Chinese are very enamored, as people are all over the world, of American pop icons and American pop institutions.
But isn't the government afraid of those icons? I mean, the real pop icons, Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, the Beatles, you mentioned that there's pictures of all of them in this branch of the Hard Rock Cafe. They stand for a certain defiance against authority, a rebellion.
Well, I think the party has decided, and they did this shortly after 1989, that, you know, you couldn't crack down everywhere at once. You can crack down politically, but you've got to allow some escape hatches. And so two of the ones which seem to have been permitted are, one, you can make money now. You can do just about anything you want to make money. And the second is pop culture. So these are kind of wonderful distractions that keep people away from politics, and they're also very much related to the marketplace. They're diversions.
What's happening musically in China now, in pop and rock?
It's a pretty interesting scene. Originally, it was a rather deadly situation in where most people were just imitating sort of Canto, Hong Kong rock or Taiwan rock singers. But now there's getting to be a number of people who are really quite creative, and they're really off on their own and discovering a kind of a new synthesis between Western and Eastern forms of music. One of them I write about in my book, Cui Jian, who's perhaps the best known. And he was originally a classical trumpet player from the Beijing Philharmonic. And in the mid-80s, he did what very few people dared to do. He left his official job. He gave up all of the perks that come with it. And he went out into this sort of margin that was beginning to grow up on the side of official society. Supported himself by playing in hotels for foreigners and nightclubs and by making tapes and records and selling them to kids. And he got quite a reputation. And he was very emblematic of this whole movement of people who, culturally speaking, are dropping out and they're finding places on these sort of the littoral, the margins of official society, and they're hooking themselves up to the market, and they're doing quite nicely.
I guess the government is learning that you can't have economic reform without letting in cultural changes, too.
Well, I think this is their strategy, but in the short run, it seems to have been successful because it has distracted people from politics. It's given them something to dream about, to hope about, and to exercise their hopes and ambitions. In the long run, though, I think it's much more subversive. But I don't think the Chinese Communist Party now really has much interest in the long run. After 1989, they needed a quick fix. And the quick fix was to save themselves with capitalism, to start producing. And as Deng said after his historic trip down to near the special economic zone near Hong Kong, you know, it doesn't matter whether you call it capitalist or communist. What matters is, does it produce? So this is the new hallmark of success. And if it produces, it's good. And that's what people that's what their guiding light these days.
So do you think the government is hoping that prosperity will give the middle class a reason not to rock the boat?
Well, I think it already has. China is developing a middle class. And I think in certain very fundamental ways, the middle class is the most conservative class in China. Now, this runs counter to the argument that the market ultimately will open up Chinese society and create a civil society, alternative institutions, and things of this nature. But my own reading is that in a curious way, even as life becomes more relaxed in China, it has a funny way of not only conservatizing the nouveau riche, but also of sucking the air out of the room so that legitimate culture and politics have nothing to breathe. Because the bitter fact is that, you know, serious culture and politics don't make money. So the market has a way of marginalizing people who engage in these serious pursuits. One writer told me, I said, listen, how can you publish this experimental literature? I mean, why does the government allow you to do it? He said, they allow me to do it because nobody reads it. So he was just allowed to sort of peck away on that border, and no one paid attention to him, and so he wasn't a threat, because what the market wants is karaoke bars and discotheques and restaurants and sports matches, not serious fiction or serious art or opera or any of these kinds of things, which have really been suffocated by the market boom.
So are there parts of pop culture now that are doing well but that the government also sees as subversive?
Well, I think rock music is one that they really don't quite know what to do with. This rock musician Cui Jian, they usually don't allow him to perform in large venues unless he's willing to give benefits. And the benefits are for the, you know, the youth league program to send kids to school. But even sometimes then they cancel them because people get so rowdy, they get so cranked up. I saw one concert in Nanjing, and it was just amazing. You know, there were 30, 40,000 kids in a sports arena, and there were probably 4,000 military police in there trying to keep control. But you could see he was touching their heart. Even with his very oblique and cryptic lyrics, there was something about his rebellious spirit and the energy of his music that reached into the hearts of these kids who had no other way to express their frustrations. The police were very, very nervous. And I write about this in my book, there's one section of the audience which was reserved for officials who had to come because it was a benefit. I mean, it looked as if somebody had administered a tranquilizer to them. They were sitting there sort of stony-faced and perplexed and watching this powerful energy, this synergy between this musician and the audience. And I thought at the time, I felt I hadn't seen this sort of energy since I'd left Tiananmen Square in 1989.
I know you just read the new book about China by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudin. And they say in their book that they think that China is very confusing right now because it marks the intersection of the two most important trends of the late 20th century, the collapse of communism and the rise of East Asia as an independent powerhouse. Do you agree with that perception?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about it that East Asia is the powerhouse of the future. And China, even more so than Japan, I think, will figure very large in this future. And the question is, can China slowly evolve to play a Pacific role in this future, or is it going to dissemble somehow? And if it does, it's going to be of the most profound consequence, not only to Asia, but to the world. Not only are there questions like the environment, but just imagine, I mean, if China starts spinning off refugees like Cuba or Haiti, which it already has done to some degree, I mean, it could have just the profoundest consequences for other nations. Just a few, maybe one-tenth or a fifth or 5% of the Chinese population, if they decide to break loose, that's, it's 100 million people. And 50 million people. What are you going to do with that? Well, so it's very important that somehow China be able to keep its balance. And how we might best help that happen is a question which American policymakers wrestle with at the same time. They try to figure out how are they going to express their concern over such questions as human rights and nuclear proliferation and arms sales and things of this nature. We really haven't decided how to fit these things together into a coherent policy.
Well, Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry.
Orville Schell's new book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the changing role of the U.S. military in Haiti?
The president said, as you know, Terry, the military police would establish a relationship, would try to get some kind of control over how the police in Haiti are behaving, and David Malbus will go with them on their rounds today. We also have a report from Alan Tomlinson on the destruction of weapons of a division of Haiti's military and some reaction from the Haitians in Miami as to what's going on. Also, Susan Stamberg talks to the granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright today, and we have listener letters.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Dabney Coleman, who starred as the acerbic Buffalo Bill on NBC 10 years ago, returns to the same network tonight to star in his newest sitcom, Mad Men of the People. TV critic David Bianculli looks at that show and at another new series starring a familiar face.
The last time Dabney Coleman was on TV, it was as the star of Drexel's Class, a Fox series so bad that it makes his new series, Mad Men of the People, look great. But it isn't great. It's in a great time slot, but it doesn't deserve to be there. Mad Men of the People shows up on Thursday nights right after Seinfeld, one of the best pieces of primetime real estate in all of TV. Coleman plays a magazine columnist whose new boss is also his daughter. She's played by Cynthia Gibb, who co-starred last season with Bette Midler in Gypsy. And Gibb and Coleman work well together. But in the pilot, they're given a lousy script to work with, so they don't get a chance to act, much less shine. In fact, the only halfway amusing scene in the first show comes when Dabney's character gets an unwanted anniversary gift from his son, played by John Ailes.
Hey, happy anniversary, Dad.
Oh.
Here's that present you made me buy.
Dylan. Son, I'm deeply touched by your heartfelt sentiment here.
Cool.
The video, huh? Ren and Stimpy. The greatest hits, huh? Oh, volume 4.
This is the greatest one. Stimpy goes to the dentist and Ren yanks all his teeth. I'll tell you what, Dad, I could keep this in my room with the Super Nintendo I got you for Christmas.
Why don't you do that?
Happy anniversary.
Even though the laughs are that broad and that rare, Mad Men of the People is being called the most probable hit show of the new season. Why? Because it's after Seinfeld. They say that timing is everything, but in TV, time slot is everything. Last week, the time slot after Seinfeld was occupied by the sneak preview of another new NBC series, The Martin Short Show. After that preview, it moved to its Tuesday slot, where it drew attention to itself by having Steve Martin as the special guest star. Now, old-time fans of SCTV, and that includes just about everybody I know, have got to watch this show. But they've also got to be patient, because the early going has been pretty uneven. The Martin Short Show is sort of like the TV variety version of The Larry Sanders Show. It's a comedy series about a guy who stars on a TV variety series. and it presents his offstage life as well as what he does on TV. So far, the offstage stuff has been a little weak. The home life is a little too sitcom-y, and there's not much reality to what goes on backstage. But when the Martin Short Show is showing the show within a show, if you follow me, that stuff is sheer brilliance. In fact, it's like watching tiny new episodes of SCTV. After all, former SCTV player Andrea Martin is a regular, while Eugene Levy, another SCTV veteran, is the director and an occasional featured player. And Jan Hooks, who plays Marty's wife and the co-star of his TV show, is just as good a sketch comic as any of them. Here's a taste of the show within a show. In this sketch, Levy plays the host of Halfwits, a truly stupid game show, who has to deal with truly stupid contestants, like the one played by Martin Short.
I'm talking to Lawrence now. Lawrence Orbach.
Right away.
And I understand you're still in high school.
Yes, I'm having some degree of difficulty getting out of high school. I'm in a freshman slump. A long one, yes.
Well, hopefully that slump won't last too long, Lawrence.
Thank you, Alex, because I have certain goals in life I would feel compelled to complete.
Ah.
One of which is to become a circuit court judge. And the other is to become a professional actor like Mr. Robert De Niro.
Ah, good for you, Lawrence.
Only not quite as tall.
Yes, well, you've chosen a very, very challenging profession.
Hey, Alex, are you looking at me? Because if you're not, then who is looking at me? You?
Or the one played by Steve Martin.
Yes, well, Silpelsian. Silpelsian, that would be...
My name.
Yes, yes, that's your name. I'm wondering about the ethnic derivation of the name, where the name comes from.
I see what you're driving at. Have we met?
Okay, you know what?
Oh, Alex, how many points do I have now?
Tommy, we haven't started the game yet.
Ah, so it gets tougher than this.
That's better sketch comedy than you'll see anywhere else on TV these days. All the Martin Short Show has to do is to get the other elements of the show up to the same level, and it'll be a series that deserves to be a hit. Maybe even a hit that follows Seinfeld.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. We close today's show with the music of Jimmy Hamilton, the great clarinetist who played with Duke Ellington's orchestra from 1943 to 68. He died Tuesday at the age of 77. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, a concert of Cole Porter songs with Barbara Lee and an interview with singer Barbara Cook. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.